Joan Didion changed the way many of us understand grief with her 2005 bestseller, The Year of Magical Thinking, and the play that was later adapted from it. It is about surviving the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn. But just as that book was being released, Miss Didion was faced with another tragedy, the death at the age of 39 of the couple's only daughter, Quintana Roo. Miss Didion described trying to come to terms with Quintana's death and confronting her own mortality in her new memoir, Blue Nights. It's published by Knopf. I spoke with Joan Didion in November, and I began by asking, didn't you once say that you don't know what you think until you write it down? Did you write this book to help sort out and clarify your feelings about the loss of your daughter?
Totally, because I hadn't dealt with it at any level, and I needed to.
You were just involved, you were just in denial?
I wasn't in denial, but I hadn't worked it through.
In an article that...
You don't really work anything through just sitting around and thinking about it. You have to write it down.
Well, some people have to, and that's probably a very good way to deal with this, because as you're writing one thing, your mind is already thinking of the opposite
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. You're arguing with yourself.
In an article that appeared in the October 24th issue of New York Magazine, Boris Kutcher said that you told him that you'd written Blue Nights to get Quintana's death off your mind, but also that writing it was a way to bring it back. Is that kind of contradiction something that we should expect in an instance like this?
I think so. I don't think there's any straightforward way to tell that story, you know, to tell that story.
Quintana was already ill when your husband John died suddenly from a heart attack.
She was in the hospital in a coma. Yes.
And he had gone to visit her that day.
He'd gone to visit her. He'd just left the hospital.
Now, had he had a history of heart problems?
He had, but that talk about denial. I knew perfectly well every heart problem he'd ever had. I had watched most of the interventions. And I still was surprised. I couldn't believe it when he died.
Well, so much of this book is about what you called magical thinking earlier, which is about not coming to grips with getting old or wanting to think about it. So is that just simply because your career was pretty terrific? You had this wonderful marriage. You did have the problem of your daughter who was seriously ill and in a medically induced coma while doctors were trying to fight this infection that she had.
But that only, at the time John died, she had only been ill for a couple of weeks. I mean, she had not been ill the entire, she'd just gotten married, in fact, a few months before.
So this was a time that it also had a positive side to it.
It was great. I remember thinking at the time that it was a very happy time.
So why? What happened here? She had this...
I always wondered if she didn't have SARS. You know, at the time, it was at the time that she got pneumonia. It was. I later realized because I was throwing out a bunch of old papers that I'd saved throughout the Gulf War, and I later realized that SARS was marching towards New York, basically, during that entire season.
The doctors didn't have any...
Well, a doctor told me, actually, that they didn't test for SARS a tremendous amount of times because the hospital's attitude was that you had to test for SARS, you had to send the stuff to Washington. And by the time you sent the stuff from Washington and got a response, the patient was either dead or discharged.
So she first had what may have been SARS or some other kind of flu-like thing. And then it became pneumonia, and then it became septic shock.
Right, which is not all that uncommon.
And when friends heard that something tragic had struck your family that day, they assumed that it was Quintana who had died, perhaps, and not John.
Right, because she had been in a... in a bad way for a couple of, you know, for a week or so.
You've said that the Year of Magical Thinking almost wrote itself in the year after John's death. This is a very different kind of book.
This is not in any way this right. It was not as easy a book to write for a lot of reasons. And when I say that it was not as easy a book to write, I'm not talking about it's not being easy because of the difficulty of the subject or the sensitivity of the subject. I think it was a difficult book for me to write simply because it was an entirely different kind of book than I'd ever written. It wasn't a narrative.
It's kind of episodic.
It was a reflection.
Mm-hmm. So it's more like a meditation.
It's more like a meditation, and it was a totally new thing for me to do.
Although you'd written essays, personal essays before.
But so long ago.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the personal essays I'd written in my 20s, really. I had stopped writing personal essays.
But this also had to have opened up all sorts of wounds. You had to reexamine your own relationship with Quintana and evaluate your own effectiveness as a mother.
As a mother, as a human being, yes.
And we'll get to that and discuss some of the other aspects of this story as we continue this conversation with Joan Didion, whose latest book is a memoir called Blue Nights. It's published by Knopf. Stay with us for more. I hope you're reading and enjoying our first book club pick for 2012, Gary Steingart's Absurdistan, which tells the story of a young Russian immigrant who must leave the United States and moves to the tiny, oil-rich nation of Absurdistan, where he finds civil war, corruption, and love. For more information and to sign up for the book club's e-newsletter, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter as well.
WNYC support comes from Wiley, publishers of Ellie Krieger's Comfort Food Fix, with healthier, lower-calorie recipes of classic American comfort foods, available wherever books are sold. Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the best cancer care anywhere. For over 125 years, devoted to patient care, science, and cancer research in New York. More information available at mskcc.org. Roundabout Theater Company's Broadway production of The Road to Mecca by Athol Fugard and starring Rosemary Harris, Carla Gugino, and Jim Dale. Gordon Edelstein directs, now in previews. Tickets available at roundabouttheater.org.
Last March, the world held its breath as Japan struggled to survive the effects of a devastating earthquake. Join us in the green space for a look at Japan today through conversation and performance with authors Ian Baruma and Roland Keltz, jazz pianist Kiko Matsui, and pop singer Akiko Yano. Presented with Penn World Voices Festival, Thursday, January 19th. Tickets at wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
We're back with Joan Didion, who is the author of 5 novels and 9 works of nonfiction. She was here in November to talk about her latest book, Blue Nights, about the death of her daughter, Quintana Roo. One of the things I asked her was, did you and John adopt your daughter the day she was born?
Well, I mean, we knew we didn't bring her home the day she was born. We didn't bring her home until she was born on a Thursday night. We brought her home on Monday.
And what were the circumstances of that? Obviously, her mother gave her up for adoption.
Her mother gave her up for adoption.
Were there any reasons other than she just couldn't?
There were no reasons. She was.
Well, you were 31 years old, and you say you felt
It was a different time, you know. Yeah.
What, giving children up for adoption?
Giving children up for adoption. It was quite a common thing. Still, this was 1966. It we're right on the cusp of when it became totally, it was not anything people did much anymore.
Well, there are still children being put up for adoption, but abortion laws have
changed that.
And now people go to other countries often
right.
to adopt children, and that is changing again. But here you were, 31 years old, and you say you felt an overwhelming need for a child. But then didn't you find yourself somewhat unprepared for the job of taking care of a baby when you got her home?
Yeah, I didn't have a clue what was involved. I mean, I remember having nightmares for the first couple of nights she was home about leaving her in a drawer and going into town to see a movie and forgetting her.
Do you think it would have been different if she hadn't been adopted, if you'd given birth to
her?
Because you have all
more,
the 9 months to think about it.
You have time to get used to having a baby. What this was suddenly there was a baby, and the baby was, I could easily have forgotten the baby,
Yeah, because it just was so not a part of your lifestyle. Well, John had come from a big family. He was one of six children. Was that helpful?
He was one of six children. No, it wasn't. I mean, it was helpful in that they were all around if we needed something. But he hadn't been brought up in a family where the boys were encouraged to take care of the children.
You found yourself treating Quintana like a doll, changing her dresses several times a day. That's because she had an incredible amount of clothing.
She had 60 dresses. I remember counting them all the time. She was given 60 dresses when she that was one thing John's family was really good about. It was giving dresses for the baby.
You mentioned thinking that you might have left her in a drawer. You write that you and John hadn't foreseen any problem with taking this newborn child with you on a reporting trip to Saigon.
Yeah, we had been going to Saigon because it was happening. And
this was during the height of the Vietnam War.
This was 1966. And we had made the arrangements and gotten credentials, and we were definitely going. And then Quintana came into our life. Suddenly we had a baby, and I didn't see any problem with I just thought we'd take the baby with us to Saigon. Now, this was a demented idea, and eventually we didn't go to Saigon because John was doing a book in Delano, the grape strike book. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed home. But had he not been doing the grape strike book, we would have presumably tried to take the baby to Saigon.
Well, of course, a child in its first year is very easy to travel with.
That's what I said.
Her name, Quintana Roo, is unusual. You got it from Quintana Roo, the Mexican state?
No, we didn't. We just had seen this name on a map when we were in Mexico, and we loved the name.
Yucatan. You'd gone to Cancun or Cozumel?
We were in Sonora, but we were trying to get out of Sonora, and we had seen this beautiful name on this totally undeveloped territory. It was not yet a state.
And now it's, as I said, Cancun.
Now it's a Club Med, yeah.
John and you were able to bring Quintana with you on many reporting trips and the book tours that took you across the United States and overseas, and you've described how she became proficient at ordering from room service in hotels at a young age. Looking back, do you think she might have been forced to grow up too quickly or that she spent too much time in the company of adults?
Well, I often fretted about that when you know, but it was in retrospect, it was simply the only way we knew how to bring her up.
And did she have friends to play with?
Oh yes.
But you write that she was at one point diagnosed as having a borderline personality disorder. How old was she
when she was diagnosed?
Yeah,
she was teenaged.
And then, how had it manifested itself?
Well, with that kind of what would you call it? That kind of quicksilver affect that people with borderline personality. I never knew what borderline personality disorder was exactly, but it seems to always involve a kind of quicksilver going from one thing to another.
Like being bipolar.
Well, bipolar is another word for it, you know. Mm-hmm.
She then had trouble with alcohol. Every parent blames herself for the problems that a child develops later in life.
We all do. I don't think it's possible not to.
What about the fact that she was an adopted child? Did she suffer from a fear of abandonment?
Well, I think that I have later been told that all adopted children fear abandonment. I didn't think this at the time. I didn't see how it was possible because we so clearly needed her at every you know, her father and I so clearly needed her. But yes, I think all adopted children have that.
Still, she was an only child, and most only children live in primarily adult worlds that their parents created before they were born, and most seem none the worse for wear. So isn't it just as likely that Quintana would have encountered the same kinds of challenges or different but equally troubling?
Had she not been adopted.
Or if she'd been raised by June Cleaver or somebody else.
Well, of course it is. And when I really think about it, I stop blaming myself, you know. But your first instinct is to blame yourself.
The what killed her was totally unrelated to all of these things we're talking about.
Yes.
You begin this memoir by describing her wedding to Gary Michael, a musician, which took place in July 2003 at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, a pretty big church to hold a wedding.
It was her idea. She didn't want more than a few hundred people at her wedding, but she wanted it at St. John the Divine.
Which is the largest Gothic cathedral in the United States.
We were lost in that cathedral.
It sounds like she really personalized the wedding. Could you tell us?
Yeah, she wanted to make every decision, and she, for example, she wanted the kind of little sandwiches that she had had at her 16th birthday party.
Cucumber and watercress.
And she wanted the little girls who were bridesmaids to wear, not to carry bouquets, but to wear leis, because we had spent a lot of time during her childhood in Hawaii, and she thought of leis.
And then she had a peach-colored wedding cake from Paillard.
Yeah.
So this was very much like the things that gave her pleasure. It was almost like a comfort food
wedding. It was a comfort food wedding, yeah.
You've provided the toast that John gave at her wedding, wishing her health, happiness, love, luck, and beautiful children. At that time, I assume all of those things still seemed to be very ordinary blessings.
They were ordinary blessings.
So how long had she been married when she first developed these symptoms that that landed her in the hospital?
She was married on July 26th, and she ended up in the hospital just before Christmas.
So she had just a few months of real married life.
Yeah. I remember we were in, as a matter of fact, I remember she did her first Thanksgiving. That Thanksgiving, we were in Paris, and she was feeling, you know how children are. They always feel left out, even when they're married and have a real life of their own to live. She kept saying, "You're not going to be here for Thanksgiving." When I said, "No, we're going to Paris," and she did Thanksgiving and was, you know, totally pulled together, I thought, at that moment.
So you were kind of proud of her.
I was proud of her.
You thought the marriage was a good thing.
It was great.
And then so she's hospitalized for what looked like the flu. How long was that before she died?
Oh, it was a year and a half before she died. She died. There were a whole series of other medical problems that came out of that, the initial one.
And when you went to the doctors, did they give you good explanations for why it was lingering so long?
It wasn't that the flu was lingering so long. It was that the flu caused another thing, and then she had to have brain surgery. She was at another hospital then in UCLA.
Well, they often will say that one of the worst places to be sick in is in a hospital.
Is in a hospital.
Because there's staff infections.
She had so many secondary infections from the hospital, you know.
Was she ever well enough during this 20 months to be able to go back and spend some time with her husband?
Well, that was the idea when she finally got out of the hospital in New York. When she got out of the hospital she'd been put into because she had the flu and then septic shock. She and her husband were going to California to try to restart their lives. They were going to go out and just walk on the beach in Malibu for a while.
And what did she hope to do? He was a musician.
What did she hope to do? Well, you mean
in her life?
She was a photographer. And they were only going to California for a short time, but they got off the plane at LAX, and she fell down, and she bled into her brain.
You kept a number of mementos of her childhood, including photos, baby teeth, even poems and lists that she'd written. And I guess you must have assumed that, like most parents do, that they would help bring back happy memories.
Well, in some ways they did, but I don't rely on them to.
Well, you say that they remind you of how inadequately you had appreciated those events at the time that they happened.
That's not a happy memory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you're saving those mementos anyway?
Well, for the time being, yes, I am.
You've said that it doesn't comfort you when people tell you that at least you have your memories.
You have your wonderful memories.
Years ago,
people always say.
Years ago, when I lost almost everything in a fire, people try to comfort me by saying things like, at least you're alive.
At least you're alive.
Yeah, I would have preferred something like, so sorry for your loss.
Yes, it's
Why
simple.
Do you think people, I mean, they're trying to make you feel better about things, but.
You know, very few people know how to actually comfort somebody who's in trouble. I noticed that when Quintana was dying, people didn't want me to talk about it. People did not want me to say that she was dying. They wanted me to pretend she wasn't dying.
That she was going to get better.
Yes.
Has Quintana's death led you to think about your own aging process in a way that John's death didn't?
John's death did too. I mean, for one reason, I had never really thought about getting older because I saw myself through John's eyes, and he always saw me as younger.
And a doctor suggested that you'd made an inadequate adjustment to aging. You write that you made no adjustment
None.
To aging.
None whatsoever. I still have, and weirdly, I still haven't.
Well, most people try to put off thinking about getting old unless they're forced to for health or financial reasons. Were you avoiding it longer than most?
Well, I think I've avoided most things longer than most. I mean, I have not actually faced up to a whole lot of stuff.
Well, when you celebrate a birthday, you've just recently passed your 75th birthday. 75 is a substantial amount of time.
It's a long time. Yeah.
And you say that you've begun to experience occasional moments of panic and fear. You worry more about becoming frail and falling. And you did fall.
I did fall.
You say your memory of how and why you'd fallen includes being taken in a taxi to Lenox Hospital and waking up in driving Miss Daisy.
Well, it was one of those things. You're in the hospital and people are treating you like a child, you know.
Just one more thing, because we're running out of time, but you were doing physical therapy and you thought this might be very good for you because all of the people around you were so fit?
Were so fit.
Who were they?
Well, then I discovered it on my third week that they were the New York Yankees.
And they were working out there.
Yeah.
Well, that gives you hope for the future, doesn't it? And Joan Didion, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Her latest book is a memoir called Blue Nights, and it is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Errol Lewis, host of New York One's Inside City Hall, joins us to talk about Governor Cuomo's State of the State address, and then we'll take a look at an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art on the master painters of India from the year 1100 through 1900. William Doyle tells the story of an American Special Forces officer who was instrumental in turning the tide of violence in the Iraq War, and David Hanna discusses the battle between two sailing ships off the coast of Maine that turned the tide of the War of 1812. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Keith Korn and contributing producers Virginia Doris and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.